Hey, what's up, sports fans? Welcome to Sports Odds and Ends, the show for the fly-by-night sports fan. I'm King Kaz. I'm joined, as always, by my good friend and co-host, the one, the great Jay Veezy.
Kaz, you're an anime guy, right?
Somewhat, yeah.
I'm not much of an anime guy, but, you know, there's a couple that, you know, kind of always catch my attention, and one of those is One Punch Man in recent years. I think I've found the human real-life equivalent of One Punch Man, and that is Deontay Wilder, who we've talked about on the show before. Mm-hmm. But I think last night might have been kind of the most egregious example of a guy fighting for about 7 rounds somewhat ineffectively and then just knocking a dude out with one punch. We've got the video of that if you want to check it out in the show notes. But yeah, I think Wilder has been, before the fight, I think he came in with 95% of his fights ending in a knockout. I think some of his fights before, he's thrown a lot more punches. But in this one, to quote our esteemed producer DJM, so Deontay Wilder built up a meter the entire time, and when it was right, boom. It really felt like a video game where he was just charging his right fist for the entire fight, and then just found a nice little opening, and then just, you know, punched the guy's soul out of his body. It was interesting to watch because it was kind of boring the entire time, but then it's like you just know he has this reputation, so like, you know, he says his opponents have to be perfect for 12 rounds and he only has to be perfect for 2 seconds. And that is like, every time I watch him, it seems like that description just gets more and more dead on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Because from what I've seen of him, I wasn't very familiar until we started talking about him, but from the highlights and kind of things that I've looked at, right. He's not a boxer in the sense of boxing, right? Like he's not doing a lot of kind of flashy movement. He's not like really, really, really looking to counterpunch or do all of these kind of things. He's not trying to break you down. He's literally looking for that one opportunity where your guard is down and he can throw a big shot. And it's just kind of very interesting to understand that he can just kind of play to that power of just waiting, like literally just kind of waiting for an opportunity rather than trying to make one, which is generally kind of the understanding of what boxing is. You're trying to make that opportunity. You're trying to feign your opponent into a mistake. Whereas, like you said, he just waits for that second where he's like, oh, okay, here's that moment. Did I get it or did I not? You know?
Yeah, and just to be clear, like he's not like completely devoid of throwing punches, but it's almost like he's throwing like little jabs to just measure his opponent and then like test his opponent for a couple rounds, to at least if you were to believe him when he talks about his strategy, it's like he's just kind of testing his opponent to see what his opponent does, how his opponent moves and reacts to certain types of punches, and then he'll start unleashing bombs later on. And then some opponents, it takes him a little bit longer because he's had a lot of first round knockouts as well. So Luis Ortiz, who he knocked out in his fight last night, was a fighter that he respected a lot and really took it to him from a very skilled boxing perspective. So I think he had to be a little bit more careful, but yeah, it's Like it did look like everything he was doing was just kind of soft and, you know, not trying to wear his opponent down, but just trying to feel his opponent out so he could find that one opening and unleash his one punch of epic destruction. I think there's heavyweight boxing has been, I mean, along with boxing in general, has been kind of, you know, below the radar recently, but you know, it's interesting characters like Wilder, you know, these anime type characters that can get people interested in the sport again.
Yeah, I agree. So let's talk about something that has, well, we've been waiting for. So the other shoe essentially has dropped on that Steelers-Browns fight that we talked about last week or a couple weeks ago. So we were talking about the fact that Mason Rudolph, the quarterback for the Steelers, who kind of in a sense initially started that fight, had not been fined at the moment. And I think as the time went on and everybody kind of got to mull over the footage, it was very clear that Mason Rudolph was a little bit of an aggressor in that fight. So he's been fined $50,000. And then, as I understand it, 33 players and the two teams have been penalized for a total of $732,000.
Yeah, most of them are like $3,500 fines for just entering the play and entering the
fight area. So as I understand, most of those players were bench players that stepped onto the field and kind of made moves towards that, which in general, if you're not one of the designated 11 people who are supposed to be on the field, it's already a big no-no for you to step on the field in the first place. Coaches and staff members get fined for teams get fined for that a lot, relatively quietly.
In basketball, like if there's a fight going on and you step onto the court from the bench, then you are suspended for a game. Like they take that very seriously, and that dates all the way back to like the Knicks and Heat fights from the 90s, which you probably remember as a kid. It's like don't add your, like, this is already a messy situation, don't add your body to this, even if you're not going to actually like fight, even if you're trying to go in there to pull it apart, or like let the people that are out there already handle that. And
which is funny because then you have the total opposite of baseball, where it's just kind of like,
yeah, everybody go out there. Like if it's hockey, just like, you know, everybody has to fight. It's part of the thing. Like if you're the goalie, go find the other goalie and you guys fight it out for a little bit, even if you're just going through the motions. And yeah, so I mean, football is the opposite, and this was a messy situation. And I think specifically in Mason Rudolph's case, well, I think part of the distinction and part of the delay was they might have wanted to get, I'm trying to approach this from like the NFL giving them the benefit of the doubt, but I think they wanted to get the suspensions done first because those guys need to be, you know, like in time for the next set of games to make sure that those guys can miss those games early on. They ended up reducing one of the suspensions from 3 games to 2. And then I think another part was like, they didn't want to suspend the guy, or they didn't want to fine the guy who got hit in the head with his own helmet at the same time that they were punishing the guy who did the helmet swinging.
So let's circle back for a second, right? I've looked at that video a couple of times. I've seen people on ESPN talk about it a bunch. And now kind of having this understanding that Mason Rudolph was kind of the aggressor in trying to pull off that dude's helmet, which is what it is if you go and look at that video. Do you think, and DGM, I would love for you to weigh in as well, that Mason Rudolph should be suspended for some games, or do you feel like the $50,000 fine is compensation enough?
I believe he should have been suspended from the beginning. Probably not the same amount as Myles Garrett, but I believe he should have been suspended two games, if nothing else. The fine is significant, sure. Is it a whole game check? I don't know. But I do think that he should have served a suspension, because regardless of what is said or isn't said or what was said or what wasn't heard, by all accounts, he was the aggressor. He was the initiator. He was the instigator that led to this blowing up the way it did. So I believe from jump, he should have served a two-game suspension, if nothing else.
Okay.
So the weird thing about this is, so Myles Garrett is going to lose a ton of money from missing salary for his suspension. But the actual suspension that Myles Garrett received was $45,000, which is, I believe, less than Mason Rudolph's fine. It's weird how like those things kind of add together. Well, I guess it's not that weird. It's just math. But it's like a lot of these fine amounts, like we're giving you the rounded numbers, but they're all these weird unrounded numbers. Like the 3500 is actually 3507, and I think some of that is just it's dependent on like they want to set it as like a percentage of a person's weekly salary, and I think to answer DJM's question, I believe this did wipe out Mason Rudolph's entire weekly salary, or at least more than that for this. So that's somewhat substantial. I do also believe that that he should have been at least suspended for at least a game. And obviously like Myles Garrett's reaction was an overreaction to that. I think had he just thrown punches or something, then that would have been like a one or two game suspension. I think when you instigate a fight, I think you got to get at least a one game suspension. And when you instigate like a massive thing like this, I don't think you can be penalized for something that got completely out of control. Or at least you can't be penalized for how out of control it got, but you can be penalized for starting it and for doing something egregiously wrong, like trying to rip a dude's helmet off. One or two games would have been fine. I guess the Steelers are kind of in a playoff chase, but like that shouldn't really matter.
No.
Like, that should be more reason to not do something like this.
But all right, so let's move into, we're still talking about suspensions, but let's talk about some college suspensions. Chase Young served a two-game suspension, player for the Ohio State football team, and upon his return to the game, he was able to set the single season sack record. Try saying that three times fast.
So our reports about Chase Young and James Wiseman being, you know, completely done with sports or with amateur athletics and being completely ineligible were premature. I guess the leagues saw like these guys are important. So they've kind of found compromise solutions. Two games was, like you said, that was the suspension for Ohio State or for Chase Young. And Ohio State has continued to win games in his absence. And they've got one game left against Michigan. And, and if they win that, that'll be an undefeated or that game left. And then I think the Big Ten championship game. I believe they have a championship game And then
we're not
the college
here on college football, so yeah. So forgive us.
There's so many different because the Ohio State Buckeyes are in Big Ten territory. JVZ, you nailed it. You pretty much nailed it. They're looking at an undefeated season. They will have the Big Ten championship game, and they are almost certainly going to make it to the college football playoff. And Chase Young has been that rare example of a defensive player that could be in consideration for the Heisman Trophy this year.
And like you said in the chat, Tank for Tua has been replaced by Chasing Chase. So I mean, pass rusher is one of those positions where they have the potential to go number one overall in the draft. Either you get a quarterback, you get a guy who protects the quarterback, or you get a guy who destroys quarterbacks. And Chase Young is a guy who has destroyed quarterbacks at a rate never before seen in Ohio State football in the past. 16.5 sacks this season, and I want to say that's after 11 games. That's 11 Ohio State games, two of which he missed. So that's like out of 9 games, and that's a tremendous record.
Let's talk a little bit about James Wiseman's situation before we move into our big stories of the week. So he was suspended for 12 games and then forced to donate somewhere in the realm of $11,500 to charity.
Yeah, that's the amount that he supposedly received from Penny Hardaway for moving expenses. So that's it, basically this forced donation is essentially like, okay, if he gives up this money somehow, then he'll be back to zero. He'll be back to even. He'll be back to having made no money during his amateur career, and they can call it good. And then, you know, 12 game suspension for breaking the rules. So yeah, that's the NCAA's way of saying like that you correct this situation and then pay a slight penalty. You're not going to be suspended for the whole season, but it also provides this really weird look where a guy not only has not made money, but he's at least if you interpret this from the start of his college career, he's had to pay to play college basketball. Assuming he does this and doesn't decide, fuck this, I'm going to go play, you know, somewhere else. Like,
I mean, that's just it's such a weird thing.
He could play in the G League and make $35,000, or he could pay $11,500 and continue to play for Memphis. So that's.
I don't know. It's so aggravating, right? Because if we take things at face value and that money, in the best light, right, was used for moving expenses, that's money that he just doesn't have, right? It just seems
it's not like he pocketed it. It's already been spent. So yeah, he would have to find a way to raise that money.
Yeah. So that's just dumb. And
I don't have $11,500 lying around and I make pretty good
money. So. I don't really know where to go from that one. So I think it is time we talk about our big stories of the week. Somehow, some way, we are not moving away from suspensions and fines, though. We have some Riot scandals, or the company that owns League of Legends, the esports competitive gaming kind of giant in the scene. We have a little bit of an issue down in Korea. So Riot Korea cracks down on CV Max for abuse, but also for whistleblowing.
Yeah. So Griffin director Cho Yoon-nam and and their coach CV Max have been suspended indefinitely by Riot Korea, and they've also fined the Griffin team the equivalent of $85,000. This is after they supposedly bullied their backup jungler Kanavi into signing a contract, and he was a minor at the time and he didn't have adequate representation. So yeah, they kind of exerted their influence on him. And then there's also allegations of verbal and physical abuse by CV Max. And there's been, you know, at least three players or so that have spoken up about that. So I guess there's not a whole lot of disagreement about that, but yeah, there's also a question of whether CV Max is being retaliated against because he exposed a couple shady practices that Griffin was engaging in with their contract stuff, and with I think they were assigning some of their players representation from a company that they had, from like a legal organization that they were using for themselves. So so there could have been a conflict of interest there. This has basically made it, this scandal has made it all the way to the South Korean National Assembly, who, you know, because this is kind of part of the whistleblower protection, Whistleblower Protection Act, whatever the equivalent of that act is in Korea. So it's you know, there's allegations of forgery, there's allegations of misrepresenting players. And there's kind of the prevailing thought that this is happening among so many other teams, so why is CV Max kind of being punished for revealing this? There's kind of this weird cultural question of like, are all these teams engaging in this level of abuse of their players? Is that possibly why? And some of it I think might be a little bit, I think racist might be the wrong word, but like culturalistically insensitive, to be like, oh yeah, like all those Korean players are good because they're all basically being beaten every time they lose.
I don't know, muddied
this whole story in this description, but this ESPN article kind of breaks it down a little bit, but it's not just about the penalty that's been issued for CV Max. There's also kind of this this uprising that's, I think people are not trying to argue that CV Max shouldn't be punished for this, but it's a matter of like, why it's only CV Max being punished for this and not other people. And he's revealing things that are going on behind the scenes that are shady. So this looks like retaliation as well for revealing those things.
All right, Cass, go ahead.
Okay. So we had a little bit of an audio hiccup there, but JVZ, as you were saying, you don't want this to feel, you don't want it to feel like culturally insensitive to say that, like, it's a sense of like, you know, almost child abuse and
yeah, like all these Korean players are really good at the electronic sports because they're basically just getting beaten by all of their coaches every time they lose. Yeah. And that's okay because that's how the culture is in Korea over there and stuff like that. I mean, the government has basically said like this is not okay. You know, and Riot Korea has said like physical abuse is clearly not okay, verbal abuse is clearly not okay. So they clearly have rules against all this stuff.
They do, but the problem is, and I think this is kind of a sense of more of these things coming to light as we start to go through. We've seen kind of these big like things in esports, but we're starting to see a lot more of them in the K-pop industry, where K-pop artists are starting to sue their labels over these kind of same things, forcing, you know, these long contracts and having them sign when they're children, and forcing them to practice for hours on end. And there's been a lot of similarity between the two. And I think as more eyes start to get onto both of those industries, K-pop and esports, more and more people are going to start to kind of speak out against those things. Like, I don't know if it always teeters into the, you know, the physical and verbal abuse, but there is a lot of manipulation in making players or getting players or coaxing players into signing really long contracts. Like the amount of hours people spend playing the game in general, like practicing. Like 12, like there was a story a long time ago about a team in StarCraft that forced their players to play like 12 hours a day without taking breaks. And you know, it was initially kind of looked at as like trying to make them the best, but I think as we're getting in to understanding the bad of those things, where, you know, people are looking at that more as, you know, bad things. When you try to kind of mask abuse as training, in a sense.
And and that can be done as like, you know, like actually abusing them or like manipulating them, like you said, into like, mm-hmm. this is you know, like you have to do this work if you want to be really good. You have mm-hmm. to work this hard. You have to work yourselves into the ground. And yeah, so it's like, now this is kind of a question of, you know, is CV Max just a scapegoat for a practice that is kind of industry wide, or is it, or not necessarily industry wide, but, you know, league wide, at least for the Korean league. I think this is kind of one of the bigger scandals in League of Legends history. I think it's been mentioned on the same lines as the StarCraft match fixing scandal in Korea, which I don't know a whole lot about, but you know, that also sounds like a huge deal, and maybe you remember some of that.
No, I do. It's very long, and I don't think we have the time now, but it was match fixing as you know it, having certain players lose so other players could be better, especially in the format that they had, and it was a lot of things that were forced upon players that you could tell definitely shouldn't have lost matches that they did. So it was interesting.
Yeah, so I guess to describe the seriousness, it's a scandal that is serious enough that it can discourage people from participating in the sport, because either they don't believe in it or they think they're going to be subject to conditions that they don't want to put up with. That's bad. It's bad for the long-term future of the sport.
So moving from Korea to the American teams, one of the more prominent teams, Cloud9, who are generally looked at as a pretty good, clean organization, has some dirt come down on them for how they were doing equity stakes. So the LCS is cracking down on them. So I'm trying to fully understand this.
Some of this might not actually be like, it's sort of one of those things where it's like, it's their fault for mm-hmm. doing this, but they also, like, it doesn't necessarily look like they were trying to hide it either. Like they submitted some paperwork that included some of this stuff, and then it got filed, but that filing was an error. Somebody should have caught that. they should have caught that they were issuing these equity stakes to all these players, because it's kind of a matter of like who knew about these equity stakes and who didn't, because some of these players that received equity stakes ended up leaving the team but not selling their equity stakes. So so now you have this weird situation where teams are playing for, or players are playing for other teams, but still own stock in Cloud9. And so that's like a big no-no. That's a big conflict of interest. So, so the team is being punished for the fact that they did this, but also like Riot is having to, or at least the North American League Championship Series is having to like change up their policies to make sure that there's more review of contracts so that they don't let something like this slip through next time. But yeah, for now it's they're fined $25,000 per player that they did this with. I couldn't find anywhere in this mm-hmm. article how many players that is, or $25,000 for a total of $175,000. So that's, if I did the math right, that is seven players. And and they also have to negotiate buyouts with those players for like their existing stakes, including the ones that they still have on their roster, which I don't think is many of them because they're kind of undergoing a big roster overhaul right now. So as part of these negotiations, all the players have to have agents representing them to negotiate. They can't like bully the players into into not taking buyout money for the sake of the team. Not that that's something that they would do, but it's just always nice to protect against that. It's like what we're seeing here with both of these stories is competitive gaming and a lot of the stories that we've done in recent weeks, more examples of competitive gaming kind of being in its infancy, not having a whole lot of eyes on it. And so these are the kind of scandals that just kind of slip through the cracks while these new leagues figure out what they're doing. Like for traditional sports, they've had leagues that have existed for 50 years or so, and stuff still slips through the cracks. There's still scandals all the time. They still have to change up the rules to paper over a couple cracks here and there. League of Legends is a game that's only existed for, less than a decade so far. So it's, or maybe we're getting close to a decade now, but
are at a decade. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's, you can imagine the amount of shady shit people got into, in the early days, some stuff that's, probably still going on, but hidden for now. That won't come out for another 5 years, some stuff that people are trying to do now, but now that there's more eyes on it, more stories, more reporters covering this, they're doing a better job of uncovering this and kind of comparing it to the traditional sports model and asking, is this okay? And, on top of that, these equity stakes, it's not something you would see in traditional sports, so it's a completely new thing. It's a kind of a creative way to pay your players, but you have to be above board in how you do it. Like we've seen with Bjergsen's contract from TSM, that was above board, that was announced to everybody. That was kind of the right way to go about this. And so now if, for some reason Bjergsen ever leaves TSM, everybody's going to remember, hey, this guy has equity stakes in this team. So he has to sell them before he ever plays for another team. Otherwise there's a conflict of interest. So it's, all these things where it's like, we've got a bunch of, I don't want to call them kids because they are young adults, but, it's a young game. It's a young set of players and it's a young set of executives as well, mm-hmm. and team owners. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, the, you know, compared to sports where they're, you know, the, like, in football, like, all the owners are basically just old white dudes. And, you know, and it's like, it's a different demographic in esports, although it's, you know, all the rich old white dudes are trying to get in on competitive gaming as well. So eventually it's all going to mesh, but these are just more growing pains.
I think that's kind of the best way you can put it. We'll probably see more of this as we go on, like you said, and there will be more of this to talk about, but I'm not going to say it's wait and see because it's just going to happen. Let's take, this isn't necessarily a baseball story. It's more of a Hall of Fame voting story, which is a baseball writer's story. But one writer has taken a very odd stance on their Hall of Fame vote.
Yeah, the Baseball Hall of Fame voting, they do this weird thing where so first of all, for like all Hall of Fames for all sports, there's like a voting system, and I think it's usually reporters that do the voting. Mm-hmm. It's the media, because they don't have the personal biases of having played within the sport, and then on top of that, they generally have to cover, you know, they have to watch a lot of games as part of their job. So it's kind of, I think that's the logic for them being the people that do the voting. I think some sports they do, like, you know, a certain number of people get inducted into the Hall of Fame every year, so they try to, you know, here's a short list and then pick like four of them that you think should be allowed in. And then, you know, so the way baseball does it, it's like, here's the short list. And then for each one of these, you vote, should they go in or not? And then if anybody gets over 70% of the vote saying that they should be in, then they're in, I believe 75%. This particular writer, Anthony Reber, basically wrote that for his Baseball Hall of Fame ballot for the class of 2020, he's going to induct Derek Jeter and only Derek Jeter as a way for him to honor Derek Jeter, which is really weird because it's like he's honoring Derek Jeter by dishonoring other baseball players. And it's kind of weird shit that it's kind of raises the question of like, how did this guy get a vote, and should he continue to have a vote?
This is like one of those things where it comes down to like, it makes you feel like sometimes this is why you shouldn't give such power to people kind of thing. But it's like, it's generally worked relatively well for so long. And then you have this one goddamn idiot who comes along and makes the whole system look weird and broken. Like, I love Derek Jeter as a player, right? Played for the Yankees, a team that I like, a team that I love. Would I vote for him? Sure. But would I also probably vote for other people that also equally deserve it as just an unbiased thing? Yes, because that's just what you do. You're talking about the game in general. Having that much of a bias is just really, really weird and seems odd. And my mind starts to almost go to conspiracy theory at that point, but like, it's just unnecessary.
Guys, there is a tradition of sorts with the Baseball Hall of Fame and the Baseball Writers Association of America that every few years there will be some sports writer that will do something wacky with their Hall of Fame ballot. And it's never funny. It's never cool. It's always this writer going out of his way to get clicks and get views and get people talking about his column. And this is no different. And what I find most egregious about this writer only voting for Derek Jeter on his ballot, Kaz, is that you know who else is on the ballot this year for the Hall of Fame? If we're talking strictly Yankees?
Yeah.
Andy Pettit. And Kaz, I'll ask you, would you vote for Andy Pettit as a Hall of Famer?
Yes. I would vote Andy Pettit before Derek Jeter.
Okay. So would I, honestly. And I just find that to be so absurd. Just that he couldn't bother to... He only voted for Derek Jeter. If he really wanted to make the point, he could have done Derek Jeter and Andy Pettit. That at least would have been a bit less absurd, because those are two players that played for the Yankees that are Hall of Fame players. There was another Hall of Fame voter who said that he should have his ballot taken away. And sometimes that does happen. And there may be some precedent here, because this is another baseball writer doing something wacky with his Hall of Fame vote, and it's silly, it's stupid, it's ridiculous. And yeah, there are plenty of players, and he tries to write in a piece where he makes the case for the steroid players in the steroid era, but he didn't actually vote for any of them in his ballot. But he wanted to talk about Derek Jeter in this piece so much. He didn't say a word about Andy Pettit, which I just found so odd. He compared Jeter to Joe Montana and Wayne Gretzky, and just the actual piece that he wrote about it was really absurd.
How many years before? Because the other egregious thing about this is that, like, certain players have a limited number of years of eligibility before they're no longer allowed on a ballot anymore. It's like, you know, certain, because part of his logic was that, like, you know, there's players that, you know, he can vote for, he can just vote for them next year because they're not in their last year of eligibility. But then, you know, if they don't get in this year, then they take up space next year on next year's ballot. And there's other players who, you know, are kind of on the borderline that might miss out because of shenanigans like this. If everybody were to do shenanigans like this, I think this one writer isn't going to influence everybody else. But
one of those people probably on the fence is Larry Walker, who I think it's his, according to this, is his 10th year on the ballot. And I don't know what the threshold is.
There's a certain number of years because I think the logic is like, okay, after this many years of evaluation, I believe it's 15.
Okay.
Yeah. So after 15 years, you haven't reached the threshold, then you will never reach the threshold. It's time to talk about some other people, which I think is okay.
Obviously, like you said, a lot of the steroids guys have been on there for multiple years, and kind of always kind of go back and forth. But like, even just kind of mulling over this list, right? Okay, Derek Jeter, yeah, we're already talking about him. DJ mentions Andy Pettit. Billy Wagner is on this list, a really good player.
Gary Sheffield, Todd Helton,
Gary Sheffield,
Cliff Lee. Like, these are names. These are names.
Yeah.
And then throw in all the steroid guys, which there's a legitimate argument to be made that maybe they, you know, it's time to forgive.
That's a whole other podcast, man, to talk about that one. But
again, the baseball writers of America are just.
Yeah, they're so I think one of the scandals in the past that this story has kind of alluded to is and we briefly mentioned it before in the Deadspin stuff, but Dan Le Batard, radio host and ESPN personality, sold or had a Hall of Fame vote from back when he was a writer, and then he He didn't sell it. He basically gave his vote away to Deadspin. And what Deadspin did is they just pulled their viewers, or not their view, their readers of like who should be in. And you know, and then you know, Levitard reviewed it and then agreed with everything and submitted Deadspin's crowdsourced vote as his vote. And it turned out like, you know, there wasn't anything crazy on there. It was like a perfectly legitimate voting ballot. But like, had Deadspin not said that they were doing this, and you know, and then later revealed that it was Dan Levitard's ballot, which he was fine with, by the way. But like, you know, the idea was that like, if you crowdsource this to most of the fans are educated enough to put together a pretty decent ballot. You know, like everybody's going to have some weird things that they feel about, but like, yeah, if you just crowdsource it all, it's all going to kind of average out. And you know, yeah, you're going to have the one weirdo that's going to be like Derek Jeter and only Derek Jeter. But then, you know, you mix it in with all the other votes and it kind of goes, you know, all the agendas kind of go away.
This will be my last thing. And I think in a sense, and this is like kind of a separate thing, but like something like the Rotten Tomatoes thing, right? Where you have your reviewer score, right? What the reviewers, the professional people who get paid to think of movies think of it. And then you have your audience score, what the people who pay to go and watch these things think of it, right? And then you kind of, when you look at those things as a person, you kind of just meter in the middle somewhere, because sometimes one is skewed one way more than the other. And there are times where those things don't match, but I think it's a really good understanding when you have both, right? When you have both of those meters of the people who are paid to watch the sport and the people who pay to watch the sport, and you kind of find a median.
Yeah. And yeah, writers are petty. So I mean, Barry Bonds is a name on this list. And I think the steroid stuff is certainly being used against him, but I think he was such a dick to the media that I feel like they would use anything against him if they could. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean they would just use the fact that he was a dick against him, you know, and just to make him wait and just to be petty about it. And even though he's one of the, you know, the greatest hitters of all time, so. Maybe if you do crowdsource this to everybody, you end up with something less petty than what you would get with just a small group of people with each with their own individual agendas. If this guy ends up submitting this as his ballot, then I'm probably sure he's going to get his vote taken away as well. It's probably more egregious than giving your vote to a sports website and having them crowdsource the mm-hmm. vote. That's
give it to John Boyce. That's who you give it to. All right, moving on from there, last story of the week, the NBA, and this is a big one. The NBA is talking to the players union, and they are looking to kind of make some drastic changes to the regular season schedule as well as the structure of the playoffs. Though there's a lot of kind of math and like weird now tournament things that they're talking about with this. I guess the biggest place to start is the taking the regular season from about 80 something games to 78 games in the season.
Yeah. So
82.
Yeah. So currently the season is 82 games, and that's enough to play every team in the opposite conference twice, and every team in your own conference, or every team in your own division four times, and then most of the teams in your conference, but in other divisions, four times and some of them three times. So this will reduce some of those within your conference, but not within your division games to three instead of two, or sorry, three instead of four. I'm kind of getting ahead of myself here. What's causing this, I think, is, and this has been a controversy in recent years, but especially recently with Kawhi Leonard, and it's this whole load management issue, like how, which is now the fancy term for, I'm just going to rest this player in the middle of the season for this one game. And so there's been a lot of like the, you know, retired players saying like, oh, I played 82 games in the season and I played through all these injuries and you know, because that was my job and this and that. And then, you know, you look at, you know, a player like Kawhi Leonard, who basically said, had he not rested in the middle of the season last year, he would not have been able to make it all the way through the playoffs and the Raptors would not have won a championship. And, then just talk in general about, you know, an 82 game season is a really long season. That's enough to play every team, you know, at least twice. You know, most of the teams that are closer to you, like three or four times. And, you know, because of that, it makes it seem like each individual game during the regular season is not that important. And so because of that, then it feels like it's okay to take a game off here and there, which is good from a player health perspective, not so good from a fan perspective if you're trying to buy tickets to a game and you're not like me where you just buy tickets to every game. You know, because, you know, yeah, there's the, you know, the poor family that, you know, that saves up money to go take their kids to go see Kawhi Leonard come to town. But Kawhi Leonard decided he was going to rest in this game. And so then you kind of, you know, as much as they try to portray this as a team game, this is still a league full of stars where stars have a ton of power. They have a ton of draw power. They're the reasons, it's like when LeBron was on the Cavs, like you weren't going to buy tickets to see the Cavs, but you were going to buy tickets to see LeBron. So that's, you know, so when you factor all that in, it's like, this is a really long season. It's so long that players are just taking individual games off. And it's kind of hurting the bottom line if fans don't know what they're getting when they buy these tickets. They might be more reluctant to buy tickets if they think that there's a chance that the players that they pay to see are just going to take the day off.
Now, JVZ, question to you, and I think this is the elephant in the room with this entire situation, especially of the question of reducing the schedule. The story says that the NBA and the players' union are discussing this and the likelihood of reducing the schedule. Will this affect players and their salaries? Will players get paid less? And how will they feel about that?
Well, so if they just reduced the schedule, then I think, yes, they would have to come to some sort of agreement on that. And I don't think the players would want to be paid less, even if they're playing less. Along with this reduction, and so to go from 82 games to 78 games, that's just four games. The NBA is proposing putting a midseason tournament in the post-Thanksgiving period. So this will be a 30-team tournament, single elimination. So the idea is, you know, they're going to take away some games, but they're going to replace it with some more meaningful games. And so theoretically, this midseason tournament will be somewhat important. I don't know what the, you know, the prize for this would be. If it's just like a meaningless midseason trophy, then maybe teams don't take it that seriously. But they're trying to put it in the post-Thanksgiving period because, you know, that's before the All-Star break. So a lot of trades happened kind of in that period just before the All-Star break. They want to have like just this tournament take place before then. And then, and if these games are important, then fans are more likely to pay for those. If there is no loss in revenue, then there is no need to like adjust the player salaries. Bad teams don't get that far in the tournament. So maybe players on bad teams get some time off, but you know, the good players on good teams still end up, you know, playing the same amount of games. As long as that balances out and league revenue kind of stays where it is, there's really no need to adjust player salaries to scale down for the number of games. There's also the proposal to change the playoff structure so that I have this wrong in the notes, but in spots 7, 8, 9, and 10 in each conference will be put into a 4-team tournament to play for the last two spots of each conference playoffs. So that tournament is just all meaningful games. We're kind of replacing this really long season of games that are mostly mm-hmm. meaningless with more meaningful games, like this tournament in the middle of the season that every game matters. And then this play-in tournament for the last couple spots in the playoffs. And so theoretically, a team could still end up playing 82 to 83 games in a season. So because of that, I don't think there's much of a need to adjust salaries in any way. The salaries are always going to be based off of revenue anyways. I think they get like a 50% share of revenue. And that's what sets the salary cap. So even if they don't do like a manual adjustment, it will kind of correct for itself within a couple years. So yeah, like that's kind of how the math works out. Everything is supposed to balance out. They still have to negotiate all this, and they have to come up with something that that the league owners will agree on. That's kind of
now a question to you about revenue, because if this comes up with the discussion of playoff seeding and less yeah. likelihood of less teams making the playoffs, do you see teams that are not making the playoffs still being able to generate revenue?
As of right now, they don't have to because they get revenue sharing from the other teams. So it's yes, partly because like right now the Knicks are one of those teams and they generate a ton of revenue, even though they haven't made the playoffs in a while. If there's a greater, like the bad teams are the teams that players generally tend to rest against. It's always like either you're playing a bad team or you're on the second game of a back to back. Then those are times where you rest your guys. If you're on the road against a bad team and you don't feel the need to rest a player, then there's a greater likelihood that fans will buy tickets to those games, just to see those players. I do think just the overall strategy of like, make our games more meaningful is a good strategy overall for the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
Just give people more of a reason to buy tickets to a random game in the middle of the season. A 4-game reduction is not that significant when you're talking about 82 games total. But the thing is, taking away 4 games might actually open up a lot of room in the schedule and reduce the likelihood of teams having to play back-to-back games. And the NBA has kind of they stretched out the season a little bit to reduce that. They've really worked on trying to do that, or at least reduce the number of back-to-backs where like a team is playing back-to-back games while also traveling, because that takes a really tough toll on the body. Even reducing that has just raises the likelihood that players are going to play more often.
All right. And one last thing before you wrap up, this mid-season tournament thing, what do they make as an incentive for this? How do they make this as an incentive? What do they do?
Well, they're not going to do it, but what I think they should do is cap space. But
that is such a basketball nerd answer.
Yeah, it is. And it's so like not going to appeal to most fans. But like, I think
that is the most John Boyce answer possible. It really
absolutely,
is.
Absolutely. But it's hard to like introduce a new trophy in a league where like only one trophy has mattered. Like they don't even give out regular season trophies the NHL does. And even in that league, that trophy, I think the President's Cup it's called. I don't even know what it's called. That's how insignificant it is compared to the Stanley Cup. It's just a nice thing. And maybe they can like hang a banner or something for it,
isn't it supposed to be something that's kind of linked to seeding and things and stuff like that?
Yeah. I mean, are you talking about like this midseason tournament proposal or?
Well, yeah.
So I think that's what you have to do though. Like you have to tie it somehow to the team's ability to compete for the championship that everybody cares about. So like if you give teams an advantage for that, as an incentive for winning this midseason thing, then maybe they'll try.
I just came up with something just totally out of the blue, and I feel like it's if you do win this midseason tournament, the best way to do this is to reward the organization as well as the players. You reward the organization for being able to construct a team that can compete at a high level and possibly get a good seeding in the playoffs. You reward the team that wins this tournament with an extra pick in the first round. And for the players, what do the players care about? They care about financial compensation. If you win the tournament, you say you get a $15 million bonus and you have $1 million for each player. That's your bonus. You get a bonus.
Yeah. Or like, you get, scale that down, because that'll probably be four rounds for 30 teams. So like, you get whatever 15 divided by four is. I should be able to do that math, but it's like you get that share for every win, for every round that you advance in the tournament. Then and then you definitely don't have to worry about players being upset that there's fewer games to make money off of, like, because they'll be paid for each game that they win in this tournament. You give a prize there. Draft picks are a weird thing because first round draft picks are guaranteed, contracts. So some teams try to trade out of the back of the first round into the early second round so that contract is no longer guaranteed. So awarding draft picks is kind of weird. And then the end of the first round just isn't that valuable anyways. That's why I immediately jumped to cap space, even though it is a really nerdy answer, but it almost feels like that's the only capital that teams really care about. Because money on its own is not that helpful to all these billionaires. But the freedom to spend that money.
That's why I make the point of the money going directly to the players.
Yeah. Yeah, so on that part, I certainly agree with. It's just, you know, what's the incentive for the teams? I guess, you know, going further in the tournament allows them to sell more games. But
I do like your idea of cap space, though. I'm coming around on it. It's I think we found a really good balance of ultra basketball analytical nerd incentive and casual NBA fan and player incentive. I think we found a balance. An increase of cap space, depending on how far you advance in the tournament, and for players, a bonus for how far you advance or if you win.
I'm trying to think of a way to tie it to the actual playoffs, but it's like, you know, like do you get a one seed bump in the standings?
I say let the playoffs be the playoffs.
And then maybe hopefully over several years, I mean, it'll take more than several. It'll take like 30 years, but you know, maybe at some point that tournament will end up being a meaningful thing.
If you're good enough to win a mid-season tournament and you're not good enough to make the playoffs, then something's wrong. Something went wrong.
Yeah. Yeah. It is a single elimination tournament, but yeah, I don't think things can go that wrong over four rounds.
Yeah.
One last proposal in this that I'm really excited about is the reseeding of the semifinal round of the actual NBA playoffs. Currently it's divided east and west in the playoffs, eight teams from the east, eight teams from the west. There's always been these proposals like you should just seed this 1-16, the top 16 teams, because, with the west being so much stronger than the east, sometimes you end up with good Western teams that don't end up making the playoffs and they're kind of screwed. So maybe with this play-in tournament where, you know, now there's 10 teams that have the possibility of making the playoffs in each conference, that part can help alleviate
I think a straight up and down kind of seeding thing rather than, you know, the whatever and the whatever, the east and the west kind of thing is so much better, because then at the end you literally end up with the two best teams playing against each other, right? Because a lot of the times we've had these situations that we talk about where we talk about these situations where the semifinal
in the west,
right, and it's like that Western Conference game is the final, right? Because by the time you get to the actual final, that Eastern team isn't going to do much. They're going to get run over probably, and it's going to go to a Western team. So it's just one of these things kind of in general where if you just legitimately let the best teams play the best teams, you end up with such a better structure of your games, and you end up with, which is what we want, more entertaining games.
Yeah. So the early rounds are kind of kept, or the reason why the NBA is reluctant to do that, partly because it's hard to get the Eastern Conference owners to agree to losing playoff spots. Yeah. It's also because of travel. So like it's nice if you separate them, like then Western Conference teams just have to travel to the Western half of the country during the first three rounds, and then maybe they have to, and then they have to travel across the country for the finals. But what they're proposing now is to reseed during the semifinal round, so you still get that savings on travel during the first two rounds. But then after that, once you get to just four teams, then reseed everything by record, and and then you have the top four teams, and then you have the best likelihood that the top two teams are going to be playing each other in the final, even if they are coming from the same conference. So, like you said, this is just going to make all these games seem more meaningful, reduce the likelihood that you have an NBA finals that everybody thinks is already a foregone conclusion. It took half the Warriors team, getting injured last year for last year's finals to be interesting. And it was interesting. The Raptors ended up prevailing, but on paper, that on paper, had everybody been healthy, then the Warriors would have just run away with it, just like they did the couple years before that. So we won't have the Eastern Conference Finals and the Western Conference Finals anymore. We'll just have the semifinals, and with the four best teams in seeded correctly. So so I think that'll be interesting. And I applaud the NBA's, I applaud the fact that they're not just listening to all the retired players, the doing the whole get off my lawn, we did it better in our day sort of thing. And
yeah,
and
things have to evolve. You know what I mean? There's a lot of things that get stuck in the past, but I'm glad we're looking at some type of evolution. I think it's definitely necessary.
Medicine has evolved. Medicine has decided it's better if these players rest, because the frequency that they're playing is not healthy for them. And the games that they're supposed to be playing are not that meaningful. So let's make all the games more meaningful, and then we'll have a better chance of them playing. That's a better product for everybody. And then more people are likely to buy tickets. And and I would like that, because sometimes I show up to games and my friend Justin and I are the only two people sitting in our row, and it is just empty around us in the upper deck. And, let's have these games be more meaningful, and then they feel like less of a drag.
You know what's less of a drag? This show. We talked about a lot, so make sure you go over to the website, sportsoddsandends.com, to see all of the articles that we talked about on today's show. Read a little bit more and tell us your thoughts on what you think the NBA should do with its regular season and its playoffs and its players. And just tell us your thoughts. You can tell that to me on Twitter at KingKaz. JVZ is at JVZ. DJM is Call Me DJM. Also, if you really like the show and you want to show a little bit of support, you can head on over to Patreon, patreon.com/sportsoddsandends. Anything you would like to give would be definitely greatly appreciated by me and all the boys here. We thank you for listening. We thank you for joining us. We thank you for checking us out. Have a good sports season for whatever you follow, and we will be back next week to talk about more sports.